Reverend Dr. Reginald Van Stevens, and he's from Philadelphia originally. He has a doctorate. I'm not sure if it was divinity or theology or something, but anyway, doctorate. And he gives a performance. I mean, of course, he knows the scripture. He has it all down. He's mastered all of that. He's mastered all the arguments. But he knows when he stands up there in front of his congregation that he has to be prepared and he must give them a performance. That's a necessity. And the people who are there, generally middle class, well-educated, and so it's not a class thing at all. It's a cultural thing. It's they want to feel moved and maybe even entertained, but certainly a little bit of both. So that they don't feel they're wasting their time or even the dollars they contribute to the church. Like, there has to be something coming back. There has to be that give and take. And I remember clearly, I think it was the last time we went to the church, which was Mother's Day, because my aunt was visiting us in Durham, and we took her to the church because she wanted to see what it was like. And we walked in, and he said, after the service got started, he said, "Oh, I see George and Gita trying to hide back there."
Because you don't come every week.
No, we don't come every week. We weren't going every week. But he was like, and he was incorporated us immediately into what was going on. And so, of course, he said, "I see you've got somebody with you. Who is that?" And I was like, "Oh, it's my aunt." "Okay, let her stand up." She stood up. Everybody clapped. She's from Halifax. Okay, blah, blah, blah. And then he said something along the lines of, I forget exactly how everything went, but it was something along the lines of, "I'm feeling really good today. The Spirit has touched me. I feel like I got to dance." So I know that Baptists don't dance, but I need to dance. So we danced a little bit in the pulpit, and everybody was like, "Yeah, okay, nah, great." So that kind of thing is really, how do I put it? I mean, it's just, I think that I don't want to try to characterize everybody, but I do think that at least for some black writers, probably if you come through diaspora, you're interested in imitating, mimicking, following to a certain extent those performative traditions of the church. Cornel West is this. I mean, the church and musicians, the people who were freest to express themselves and express their culture historically. And so I think that in terms of writing, that's exactly where so many of us still take as our standard, to do something that moves in the way a sermon moves or even the way a piece of music moves, if at all possible. You know, so that was my big revelation in Halifax. Then I ended up going to Ottawa, where I wrote most of Wild Falls and other things. Then to Queens, of course. As you know, I was called the Ghost. I heard that. I heard I was called the Ghost because I know I didn't spend a lot of time in Kingston. Even though I had an apartment there, I didn't spend a lot of time there. It's a nice town.
But then you came back and you did your thesis. And
yes. Yeah. Yes.
That. So that was good for...
And the thesis was on?
Oh, it was a comparative study of African-American and English-Canadian poetics and poetry. I mean, the development of both, actually. It was a John Matthews administered or supervised, rather, dissertation. And I was his last graduate student. And he knew... I think he knew that I was not going to get that dissertation written unless I came to Kingston and just stayed there. I was living in Ottawa at the time, and so he made me. Because I remember he of course, had done his project, his PhD, in record time, I think within 1 year. And he expected everybody to do it that way. And he was well known for getting his graduate students through their program
quickly. He would put people on bread and water and chain them to the desk, more or less, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I'd love to know the secret.
Well, that's what he did. You had to go in and, well, he was pretty sick, but you had to go in and see him.
I didn't know at the beginning, though, yeah. You see. I mean, I think it was back in April that year. I just finished the second year and finished my Canadian comprehensive exam. He asked, "What are you going to do for the summer?" I said, "Well, you know, I've got this project and that project. I'm going to write my dissertation. You know, blithely, I'm going to write it. You know, no problem." He said, "I don't think you will. I think you'll get so tied up with everything that you won't have time and you won't get to it. And I know you well enough to feel that that's going to be a problem. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to call the graduate residence right now and book a room for you. When do you want to come to Kingston?" So So you will bring your computer, your books. Of course, we have a fine research library right here on campus who can also order in text for you if you need them. And so you will come to Kingston. And, the rooms cost $13 a night, which really isn't that bad. They're not air-conditioned, but that's okay, because that will force you to get more work done sooner, or more quickly. So, that was it. So I think I opted for the end of May, roughly. I know I was finished by Canada Day, so I was there for all of June, month. And he met with me every day until the last week when he was really, really sick. Mm-hmm. And
are you saying you wrote the dissertation in 2 months?
1 month.
Well, he tried to do his comp studying in 3 days. This is the guy who's...
Okay,
and I heard a comment which will remain anonymous. And you know what? It wasn't half bad.
That's how I feel about it, too.
Given.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. You know, and I think, too, I was influenced by Bell Hooks and her Breaking Bread collection with Cornel West, and they talk about the intellectual life. Why is it important to be a black intellectual, an insurgent black intellectual life? And I really loved her. I mean, I lived by those essays, and I was writing my dissertation because, as she writes in one of her pieces, it's the loneliest time. You know, that's when you really have to face, can you do this or not? Can you really, really bear down and write something that's halfway reasonable and a scholarly argument? And I also realized, too, that, yeah, this is an important thing. It is extremely important to come through this system. And it's just another potential barrier for people in the society, and one that people have to continue to think about traversing and crossing. I mean, I'm not making much sense here, but...
No, perfect sense.
I mean, when I went to McGill in the fall of 98 for visiting chair... as a visiting chair there, I had a talk with one young black man student who was really, really, really questioning me. Why is it important to do this work? Why aren't you out there carrying picket signs? Excuse me. Why isn't this a waste of time? He was a student, and he was asking, and he was telling me, I think it's a waste of time to be taking courses when we have so many problems in our community. We should be out there really working in the streets to try and change things. And I was trying desperately to try to convince him that this work is also honorable and it's also important and people have to do this work and you should be doing this work too. It doesn't prevent any of us from picking up the picket signs and being there for the community when the community needs us, etc. But at the same time, we need to be able to take part in this other conversation, which also defines what parameters we can use or what parameters we can occupy within the society. We need to be within the academy, in academia. And I don't think I convinced him. I never saw him again, and I feel really sorry about that. I heard that he had left McGill to do something.
You might have planted a seed. You don't know. You can't tell.
Yeah.
What was it like when you were at Duke, though? What was it like being from the Canadian background? I mean, you've written about it, and very fine you've written about, the differences, but what did it feel like?
It's strange. I think when I went to Duke, I think I went there, I was given a joint appointment in Canadian Studies and English Literature. But the understanding was I was going to work on African-American and English-Canadian work, and I did to a certain extent, but at the same time, the longer I was, it didn't take very long. I was there, I think, for just within the first 8 months, I'd started to shift my focus to African-Canadian literature, mainly because I could look at the black American feel, and as much as I love the literature and grew up with the literature, I could see, hey, there's a lot of work being done in this field. There's, what am I really going to add to it? I can write another paper on Gene Toomer, which might see something new in his work or interesting in his work. I could take another vantage point on Du Bois, Dubois, et cetera, et cetera. I could write about Rita Dove and compare her to Toni Morrison and that sort of thing. Or on the other hand, I could write papers on Michael Ondaatje and Thomas Chandler. That's it. Thomas Chandler Halliburton and so on and so forth. And I did write papers on them. and Ralph Gustafson and so on. And I did write at least one paper looking at African Americans, Malcolm X and Miles Davis, a cultural studies paper, and that was interesting. But I was asked by this is sort of, I'm losing my mind with names and everything these days, but I was asked by a Canadian scholar, post-colonialist actually, at Guelph, to write a paper on African and African-Canadian literature. That was in the fall of 94. I received that request, and I started working on it in the spring of 95. And what I discovered was there was no real suitable bibliography, that there wasn't a whole lot of work that had been done in the area. And I knew that in order to write the essay, the short essay, I was going to have to do a bibliography. I just couldn't write the essay without the bibliography, because it was just one had to lead to the other. So I started working on a bibliography. And I had support from Duke to do that. And then that got me really thinking more and more about differences between African-Canadian, African-American lit. Then by the fall of 95, I decided to teach a course in African-Canadian lit, which is probably the first ever taught, and it was taught at Duke. And of course, my African-American students had various responses to this material, which got me thinking even more about it. I taught a graduate course in the same area in the fall of 96. It was Black diasporic literature, that's right. I wasn't just African-Canadian, but it was the Canadian material that my African-American students had real trouble with. And they were trying to, and that got me really thinking about it, because they were sort of like, why is this Austin Clark guy saying that the police are okay? That's not our experience, you know? And why is it that this Denis LeFerrier is making all these jokes about interracial relationships, which are really, on one hand, maybe progressive, but on the other hand, maybe shows lack of solidarity with blackness or so on. What's the problem with these Canadian writers that their blackness seems to be really something that's not as pronounced as we can see it being in African American texts, even when it's being problematized? It seems to be far more present there than in these texts you're making us read, Professor Clark. And I'm like, does this mean that they're all Uncle Toms, or is there something else here that we need to think about? Is it has something to do with being, well, just being in Canada and having to assimilate Canadian ways, postures, viewpoints, and ideals? And also, does it have something to do with where these people are coming from? You know, and so then when I started to look at it from that vantage point, I began to see it as being a very unique African diasporic literature, because of the fact that it does come from a community that is still very much a minority. We can argue whether blacks are 3% or 5% of the Canadian population. Okay, let's say 5%. I'm willing to say that. Let's even say 10%. It's still a real minority, particularly outside the large cities. And when we talk large cities, we really mean three: Vancouver, Montreal, and Toronto. But then when we look at these three cities, the black community in Vancouver is very small. And so then you really have Toronto and Montreal. And the historical black community is represented fairly well in Halifax, but it's a small city. So, you know, what about all those places in Alberta and Saskatchewan and Manitoba where you can probably drive for many miles and never see a person of color? What's going on with that? How do we fit that into our schema, our thinking about black Canadian identity? But then what about the fact that we've had communities here for over 200 years? Are they black or not? And if they are black, what kind of black are they? What do we mean by that? How do we think about that? And can we use black American and black Caribbean and black African models to understand these communities here? Or do we just write them off, or many of them, as simply being assimilated or partially assimilated or just not black in the way that we can think of being black in the U.S. or the Caribbean or Africa? But then again, we have to keep in mind that being black in all these locations is a very different thing, too. All that, the research for the essay, just got me moving into a different area. And one that I started to see, there's a lot of work that needs to be done here. A lot of historical work, a lot of anthologizing work, a lot of editing work, and just simply a lot of critical reading and thinking about what it means. Because I think the danger I saw, and still see to a certain extent, is that people will say, Black Canadian literature begins with Austin Clark. And to a certain extent, yeah, I'm willing to concede that point with a whole lot of writers attached. If we want to talk about the first novelist to be marketed as a black writer who's saying something about the black Caribbean slash Canadian experience as being Austin Clark in English, okay, yes, I'm willing to concede that. But at the same time, I want to direct people to the first black novelist who came about in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century. What was their experience? It must have been very different. It must have been just, it must have been even weirder than it was for Austin Clark to be writing in Sudbury in 1958, let's say. But then again, for first-generation immigrant writers, they're coming from a majority black background, and not from a background where they had to act as minorities or think as minorities. That's a whole different kettle of fish, a whole different psychology that's in play. And that's another element that I think has to be addressed and thought about. And then what about the second generation writers? They've got another, I mean, you know, people who've grown up in Montreal or in Calgary, they still have a connection to their parental homeland, but at the same time, they also have a connection to the territory, the region, the city where they've grown up as Canadians, in quotation marks. How do we think about their writing? Should we think about it? Do we talk about it at all? I mean, these are things that I think, issues, questions I think are extremely important that need to be addressed in order to get a holistic picture of the culture. You know, the literature, or literatures, or cultures. I think it's interesting and exciting. They have a literature that people can call African diasporic that comes from multiple groups of people who've come to Canada over several generations and over several centuries, that in fact comprises people who in 1991, 43% of them could say, we're not black, we're English or we're French. I think that's bizarre. You would never get that in the United States. Bizarre is not the right word. It's interesting. It's intriguing. What kind of black consciousness produces those kinds of answers? Maybe it's not a black consciousness. Maybe it's a different kind of consciousness. Maybe it's a Caribbean consciousness. Maybe it's a class consciousness instead. And what kind of literature then comes from people who have that kind of approach, that kind of thinking? I mean, I think that what I've been interested in is trying to break down monolithic viewpoints of what black writing is supposed to be, especially in Canada. You know, because I know, I mean, I have this tussle with people all the time. There are folks who want to say, black writing is black because it talks about being black, and it comes from black people. This makes it black writing. And yeah, okay, I'm cool with that to a certain extent. But at the same time, I want to say, well, then what do you do with so-and-so whose characters are white? What do you do with so-and-so who wants to celebrate Britain? What do you do about so-and-so who wants to celebrate being Canadian? Does that fit? If it does fit, how do you line them up against Richard Wright or Ellison or Toni Morrison? How do they start, Alice Walker? How do you configure Dionne Brown with Audre Lorde? How does that work? You know, how do you fit these people together? How do you compare them and contrast them, and so on? Are they really making the same statements, or are their statements somewhat different? I mean, one of the key things for me that separates immediately a black Canadian from a black American writer, no matter whether the black was born in either country, is the fact that I'm going to make this claim, partly because I lived there. African America is a civilization. Black Canada is not that. Black Canada is a collection of different cultural experiences and entities. Maybe we could collapse them together and say it is a civilization, but I think that's going too far. I think maybe 50, 100 years from now I might be able to say that. Maybe 20 years from now, maybe 10 years from now we'll be able to say that. But we can't right now, and that's what makes our situation so different. What is Black America? Black America is at least, what are they, 13% of the American population. Okay, so roughly about the same population as Canada, 30 million people then. You've got 30 million people with their own television, radio, newspapers, religious structures that aren't just, as in Nova Scotia, a little group of poverty-stricken churches. I don't mind saying that because I'm proud of those churches too. Or maybe a scattering of other churches in Toronto, Montreal, southwestern Ontario, maybe a couple of chapels on the prairies. But serious, wealthy churches. Maybe not as wealthy as others, but still very, very influential and powerful. And a continuous historical tradition of writing, debate, universities. University system, a black university system. I mean, when I look at Black America, I see And to a certain extent, I see Quebec. Yeah. I mean, I see the same kind of subcultural, distinctive organization and thought patterns and philosophy and poetry and everything. And in fact, Black America does have, to some extent, the same kind of influence on American culture and politics and legal system and everything as Quebec does within Canada. You know, okay, yeah, they're both beleaguered minorities in some ways. On the other hand, we in Canada tend to think always of African America as an impoverished, police-oppressed group. Yes, African Americans are, to a large extent. At the same time, we have to realize that two-thirds of African Americans are middle class. Doesn't mean that they escape police brutality, but does mean that they have some wealth and some power. For me, one of the most significant dates in African American history that I don't even think African Americans understand as being significant is 1995. Why? The most important thing for me as an outsider looking at that culture, that civilization, in the fall of 1995, is that some of their leaders were able to convince the Clinton administration to intervene in Haiti. As far as I know, and I'm not an expert on this, this was the first time in American history that Black Americans were able to call upon the armed might of the American state to intervene for their interests, for their agenda, and not somebody else's. I mean, African Americans have always been going to war on behalf of the U.S. state, Vietnam, Korea, I mean, everywhere, all kinds of interventions, in the hope that things would be better back home once they did their service for Uncle Sam. This was the first time they actually got Uncle Sam to do something for them internationally. You know, I mean, even Somalia was not brought about mainly because of African American demands. That was newspapers. That was media in part. But this was Haiti was the Clinton administration's response to Black electoral pressure, and understanding this was a very important block of votes for the administration. It also sort of dovetailed with their own self-interest. They didn't want any more Haitians washing up on the shores of Florida. So in that sense, it was also good for the Clinton administration to act in that way, but it was over and above Republican objections. There wasn't 100% support in Congress. And as somebody who was living there at the time, I was under the impression, and still am under the impression, that Clinton would not have acted if he hadn't had strong pressure coming from Black Americans, or some Black American leaders in Congress, and Jesse Jackson and so on, to go into Haiti. That was a significant moment. I'm not sure it's going to be repeated anytime soon, but again, I really feel that was a real advance. Maybe advance isn't quite the right word. It was a real watershed in African American history that they were able to get the military might of a superpower at placed at their disposal, so to speak. You know, that's amazing. That's really amazing. Okay, Black Canadians are not in that position. Very, very clearly, very simply, not in that kind of a position. We're also a very different group of people because we have not had 200 years of shared history together in large numbers, particularly in very important, strategically placed geographical locations within the country. That has not been our experience. And so it's no surprise that our unity, in quotation marks, is going to be a lot more distressed and disparate than is the situation in the U.S., where you can get a million men or women or youth out on the street in Washington to protest or just come together in unity. You know, I think that you might get a few thousand together in Toronto on some kind of basis of Black organization to achieve something, but it will take an awful lot of work, and it will take an extremely charismatic person to do that. And when you talk about national mobilization, extremely difficult, because everything in this country, I would argue, I shouldn't say everything, but a lot in this country, even though people in Ontario don't understand it, is really regional. It's really provincially controlled. So you want a Black school? You don't go to Ottawa, you go to Toronto. You go to Queen's Park, and you better hope it's not Mike Harris sitting there in the Premier's chair. If you got Bob Rae there, you got a chance, which is what they had. Bob Rae's gone, so there won't be any Black school, unless somebody wants to fundraise, organize, and do it themselves, but I haven't heard any discussion of it. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen. But I was saying it'd be far more difficult to pull that off here, even in Toronto, than it would be in Washington, New York, where they have Black schools and Black churches and Black radio stations. You know, we got one finally in Toronto, and I think that's a really significant forward step. That's extremely significant. And it does show that there's a degree of unity, certainly, or else you wouldn't have gotten that radio station. People had to organize together collectively because no one community is large enough and influential enough and powerful enough to pull off that kind of access, to win that kind of access. And so I really took, I think, a mass-based community effort to finally convince the CRTC, after having failed twice before, that it was time for Toronto to have a black-oriented radio station. So things may be shifting, but I still think that anyone doing work in the area has to understand or come to terms with the fact that Black Canada is a far more, okay, I won't say more complex entity than African America, but certainly much more of a mosaic in terms of ideology, in terms of language, in terms of culture, and so on, than is the case in the United States, definitely. And so that makes it a lot harder to organize, and it means that the writers who come out of that community, if they choose even to call themselves Black or African, are going to have a very different kind of psychology and outlook than those who come out of the United States. And again, for me, I think that's exciting. I think that's interesting to explore, as opposed to trying to impose an American model, a Caribbean model, or an African model, because neither of those models can really work here. None of those models can really work here, excuse me, because we just have a whole different reality on the ground, which the writers themselves keep emphasizing, whether they want to or not. They keep doing it. You know, it's why it boggles my mind when somebody says to me, Black writers should be more Black, should be writing more about being Black. And I'm saying, yeah, okay, fine, but the question to ask is, why don't they? That, to me, is interesting. Because maybe it's not that they're not aware of who they are they're not aware of their history or their culture, but just because of the fact that they feel that their discourse has to take a slightly different direction because of where they are and the influences upon them, and for that matter, where they came from. And one of the most elementary things for me is, it's easy for, maybe I shouldn't say it's easy, but it's understandable that Denis LaFerriere could take racial stereotypes, as he does in How to Make Love to a Negro, and hold them out there and poke all kinds of fun at them. Of course he can do that. Why? Because he never grew up with them. You know, it's for him, these are really objects. You can look at them objectively and turn them around and twist them because of the fact that you never had to negotiate them as a kid, as a child, or see one's parents negotiate them. What did he have to negotiate? He had to negotiate being a middle-class journalist in a dictatorial country and a repressive. That's what he had to negotiate. He had to negotiate maybe being a more strict Catholic than a follower of Valdoux. These are the questions he had to negotiate being darker skin as opposed to being lighter skinned Black, because colorism is a big issue in a place like Haiti, or for that matter Jamaica. So these are issues, not whether you're Black, because everybody's Black. I mean, it's simple. And so of course you're not going to talk about being Black. If you grow up in a Black country or Black majority country, why on earth do you walk around thinking of yourself as being Black? There's no need to. Everybody you see around you is. So, what's your identity? Your identity comes out of your class and your religion, not out of your skin color. It's ridiculous. It's only when you come to North America or to Europe or maybe South Africa that someone's going to focus on your skin color. And when that first time that happens, you're going to think, what? That's insane. I went to a school that wouldn't accept you or your parents because you don't have enough money, or your manners aren't correct, or your accent isn't correct. Now, my friend is the prime minister, or son or daughter of the prime minister, or whatever. You're trying to tell me I should be sweeping your streets, or I should be tanning your leather? Come on. I should be your prime minister, for crying out loud. You know, I mean, because that's my, I mean, I'm speaking, of course, theoretically here. But, you know, I see that. I see that in, I shouldn't keep harping on Austin, but one reason why I love Austin's work is because he does address class in ways that few Canadian writers do. He sure does. He's really into class. And he takes a conservative outlook on it. You know, which I think also is valuable, because there aren't a lot of writers who do, number one. There certainly aren't a lot of Black writers who do. And I think it's a very valuable position to take. But then people don't see that, or they don't understand that, or they have problems with that. And I don't, because I think, look it. if I'm coming from the upper middle class, or I have aspirations to be in the upper middle class or upper class, then that's going to be my concern in what I write. Not necessarily about bad white people. I want to talk about how I can get my formerly middle class or upper middle class or upper class characters who've been forced into a lower class because they were immigrants back into an upper class position or a higher class status. That's what interests me. You know, I mean, I shouldn't be trying to speak for him, but that's how I see, to some extent, his work working. So what does that have to say to me as someone who's from Nova Scotia, who was born here? How does that reflect my reality? Well, it doesn't necessarily. So when someone says to me, Austin is writing about being black in Canada, I have to say, well, yeah, sometimes. And sometimes that applies to my experience. But he's also writing about trying to become upper class in Canada when you're an immigrant from a developing country. And to some extent, yeah, there are parallels there if you're coming from the black community in Nova Scotia. But for the most part, I would see my struggle as racial. And class is certainly a dimension of that, but that wouldn't be the primary dimension. Race would be my primary concern, maybe, if that's my background. So I see these questions as being absolutely essential to explore in order to have any kind of holistic vision of the literature once again. I'm trying, for myself personally, I'm trying to get away from really reductive readings where someone says, because so-and-so plays the banjo and writes about being black in PEI, they're not really black. Because being real black means you have this other kind of culture. And for me, the black banjo player from Prince Edward Island is vital. Okay, maybe because I come from Nova Scotia. And I knew people there who were black who played mandolin, not banjo, but mandolin and guitar and sang country and western music. So I'm supposed to say these people don't have a racial consciousness because that's the kind of music they play or they enjoy playing or listening to, along with funk and black gospel music, I should add very quickly. But they like to play country and western, that makes them non-black? How? Exactly how? In what way? Because other people like that same kind of music? Well, maybe it's got something to do with the fact that they come from a rural environment. Let's think about that. Maybe it's something to do with the fact that these are people who are working as small-time farmers, fishermen, women, miners, and therefore have a lifestyle where country and western music, just as an example, or folk music makes sense to them. It's their music. It's their music. You know, so I'm supposed to come down from Toronto or from Halifax and say, you're not black because you should be playing jazz? No, I need to understand why they feel country and western speaks to them. That, to me, is what I need to understand. And understand what is black about that. If I want to try to configure that as black cultural expression, what is black about that? Is it exactly the same as Nashville? Or are there nuances that make it unique and original and different? That, to me, is what I need to explore. Or is black culture only something that happens in a big city like Toronto? Or is it something that can also happen on the prairies? And if so, what does it look like? What does it taste like? What does it feel like? What kind of experience is that? You know, does it mean that it's because it's marginal, that it's not important, or we can forget about it, or just cast it out of the black diasporic community because it doesn't look like Barbados, because it doesn't look like Sierra Leone, because it doesn't look like Harlem? Of course it doesn't. It's not there. It's here. So how do we configure that? How do we understand that cultural expressivity? How does it reflect where it is? And what does that say to everybody else who's here? These, to me, are fascinating and intriguing and interesting questions. That
and they've mapped out the next few decades of your life.